Hey, welcome along. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 5 p.m. in the Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 in beautiful Newfoundland and Labrador, 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 10 p.m. in Western Europe, 11 p.m. In Cairo and Jerusalem, midnight in Moscow, and it's already Saturday for our Asian and Pacific listeners. But wherever you are on the planet, welcome to another live edition of our Clubland Q&As. If you're a Mark Steyn Club member, feel free to shoot me a question. If you're not, you can join, and we will endeavour to get to brand new club members' questions today. Looking forward to seeing some of you, at least, in Montreal for our special tapings, live tapings of the Mark Steyn Show with Douglas Murray, the great Douglas Murray, and Randy Backman, and all kinds of other special guests next week on, I think, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So hope to see some of you there. If you're if you've got impeachment on the mind, it's safe to wake up now. The hearing today ended, I think, about 45 minutes ago. And my goodness, it's shocking, isn't it? Trump removed this ambassador. Did you know that's what happened? The president actually removed one ambassador and replaced the ambassador he'd removed with another ambassador. I'm stunned by that. I'm shocked. I'm shocked he should be removed from office immediately. If you recall, in 2008, Barack Obama got rid of all Bush's ambassadors. that's the idea. As I understand it, that's the idea. That's the difference between an executive president and, say, the parliamentary system that we Canadians enjoy, is that when you elect the president, you're not electing the chairman of the board who just has to put up with all the other employees. You're actually electing an executive branch. The executive branch serves at the pleasure of the president. But that was in the old days. If you elect someone like Donald Trump, if you elect a Republican president, then that's not meant to happen. Anyway, let's get to your questions. Oh, a lot of Don Cherry questions today. I think the first one came from David Houston, who doesn't like Don Cherry because Don doesn't like the Buffalo Sabres. But still thinks he shouldn't have been fired. He was fired on Remembrance Day. In case you're... He was on with Tucker a couple of nights ago, but in case you're American or you're from overseas and you're not familiar with this, Don Cherry is a very famous man in the Dominion of Canada. In fact, a couple of years back, he was voted the seventh greatest Canadian of all time, which isn't in... I'm not in danger of that happening to me anytime soon, but it happened to Don Cherry. And Don Cherry has said outrageous things all his life. He's been on Hockey Night in Canada for four decades. Tomorrow, I believe, will be the first time in four decades that he won't be pretty much on television for Hockey Night in Canada. And he said all kinds of things about all kinds of people, including Francophone Quebecers, to whom he's not terribly partial, and indeed some of the non-Canadian players in the NHL, to which he's not terribly partial. All my life, every so often, Don Cherry says something that's absolutely outrageous, and then after a couple of weeks, it all calms down and Don Cherry just goes back to doing what he does until the next time he says something completely outrageous. And this time round, it didn't happen. He said what he said on Saturday and on Monday, Remembrance Day, Veterans Day in the United States. Monday, Remembrance Day, he was fired. Why was he fired? He was fired because he'd observed that when he walked around various parts of Canada, he noticed that you didn't see certain immigrants wearing the poppy that in Canada, the United Kingdom, all over the Commonwealth, people wear poppies on Remembrance Day, going back to that great Canadian poem that you can see me read right now at Stein Online in Flanders Fields by Lieutenant Colonel John McRae. Great poem. In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow, and that is why we wear poppies throughout the British Commonwealth on November 11th and the days beforehand. And Don Cherry pointed out that he'd noticed that the more multicultural we get, the more it's obvious to him that people, certain people, just don't wear the poppy. It doesn't mean anything to them. It doesn't resonate with them. And I think that's true. If you happen to disagree with, Don, you can disagree with him. But it accords with my experience, particularly if you walk around Toronto, that as a general observation, poppies are preferred by older people. And one does notice, but by the way, you are meant to notice minorities. In Canada, the government has an official category, as it were, visible minorities. People talk about how many visible minorities does such and such a company have on its board. Visible minorities, the phrase. Vismin. In fact, as bureaucrats like to abbreviate it, Vismin. Vismins are so-called because they're visible. So one is, if in the composition of the board of a corporation, one is allowed to deduce certain things from the lack of visible minorities, it's precisely because they're visible that Don Cherry walks around and notices there's a lot of people not wearing poppies. And he thought he'd say something about it. And what he said about it got him fired. And I do believe, who was it now? Let me just see who it is. Was it Brian from Minneapolis? I'll read out some of them because I'll maybe get to the one who I think summed it up. Dear Mark, says Brian from Minneapolis, hope you'll comment on the firing of Don Cherry. What Don said was true, that the immigrants, Muslims in particular, that now live in Canada don't honour fallen soldiers that have died for them. One of the many consequences of immigration without assimilation is that the immigrants don't share the same feelings for their newfound nation's sacrifices in the battlefield as they would if they were in their home nation. Bad enough Canada hides their war memorials dedicated to those who fought terror, but now it's a crime to even mention that refugees they welcome owe no allegiance or respect to the nation they now live in. Your thoughts, Mark? Well, at a certain level, it's obvious. That's one of the consequences of mass immigration, is that to a certain extent, it makes the overall population somewhat disconnected from the past. Because for a past to resonate in society, it has to be a shared past. Initially, if you go back to the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, people wore poppies because their parents and grandparents had served and in some cases died in that war. And that's one of the most basic reasons you can name for wearing these things. I happened to watch the Royal British Legion's Festival of Remembrance, which is in some ways unchanged from the way it was many years ago, surprisingly unchanged. But one thing they always do is they find people, and those people talk about, oh, yeah, my great-great-uncle served at the Battle of the Somme, and he died there, and he didn't come back. And that it's often great-great-uncles, because it's uncles who died before marrying and having children. But one of the features of that Royal British Legion thing is to find people with relatives who died on the Somme or wherever it was. And it's interesting that the one thing that finally took out Don Cherry, after all the people he's insulted across the decades, was actually going up against the central feature of the modern Western society, transformative immigration. Because one of the consequences of that is that you In a sense, you not only lose your future, you lose your past. Because the past, in the sense of the great Canadian battle for Vimy Ridge, doesn't resonate in the same way if an increasing proportion of your population just got here 20 minutes ago. And I know I'm careful about what I'm saying here, is that every society has, you know, if you go back 40 years and you went to Belgium, I'll take Belgium because I happen to know a bit about it. In Belgium, my great uncle, much to the irritation of certain other members of his family, he was serving in Germany, and he fell in love with a German lady and married a German woman and brought her back to his little town in Belgium. So it was a town full of Belgians, but it happened to have one or two Germans in it. And so that doesn't impact the generally Belgian character of that town. But if you have transformative immigration on a scale that completely transforms the nature of your society, one consequence is that you, as I've said in books and for many years now, is that you not only lose your future, but you lose your past as well. I often mention the Austrian thing, which is that by 2040, a majority of, which is in 20 years' time, or in other words, the distance from 9/11 to now, in other words, at the time I first mentioned this, we've actually used up half the time since, half of that available period of time. In 2040, a majority of Austrian school children will be Muslim. And this is a country that was 90% Catholic until very recently. If you'd gone to like 1940, it would have been 90% Catholic. And I've done all the gags. You know, I said, so we've gone from 1940, Baron von Trapp, Sister Maria, capering nuns, how do you solve a problem like Maria, to 100 years later, how do you solve a problem like Sharia? I've done all the gags, and I don't find them as funny anymore because they're happening, because we didn't do anything. So we're happening. But one consequence of that is that it doesn't just mean that Austria's future is completely different, but also it means that the Austria of the past, the Theater am Divin and operetta and all the rest of it, is going to be less important too, just because the people who will be living in Austria have no interest in that past and no connection with that past. That's true in small ways and big ways. The theater about 10 years ago in Vancouver closed down. Used to do, you know, standard repertoire, Noel Coward and Terence Rattigan, but Vancouver got a bit influx of people from China, and they don't want to go to Noel Coward plays. And it's not just on the fringe, elite little activities. If you go to Hispanic parts of the United States, you're not going to be having classic rock on the radio because that's less popular with Hispanics. There's all kinds of changes, but it's transformative on the scale in which Canada's done it. And if you're someone who regards himself the way Don Cherry does, then that is something worth speaking about. I will say this, by the way, that Don Cherry did something absolutely magnificent. He could have gone and groveled. I believe they offered him because he's a big deal there. They offered him the opportunity to grovel and say he misspoke. His co-host, Ron McLean, who was standing next to him and nodding along, backed off of it to keep his job, presumably. But Don Cherry said, to hell with that. I'm not going to be a politically correct robot. At some point, people have to stop telling us what you can and can't talk about. You might think, you know, we have politics and everything now, so I don't know why we can't have it in hockey night in Canada. The guy was simply saying we should all wear a poppy on Remembrance Day. It's a civic ritual. So if you're part of the polity, if you're part of the society, you show that by engaging in the civic ritual. Michael Covino says, so now that Representative Schiff and his minions in the media argue that Trump's tweets are evidence of intimidating a witness rising to the level of an impeachable offense, When will the DOJ be prosecuting members of Code Pink on similar grounds for their constant disruptions at congressional hearings? Recall their numerous outbursts at the Kavanaugh hearings. Yes, actually, it's true. You know, those bums, Democrats at Congress can't have it both ways. When I went to testify before whatever god-awful committee Ted Cruz was chairing, the Democrats let thugs into the room to harass and intimidate one of my fellow witnesses. I believe there's a little bit of video out there on the internet somewhere that shows me encountering one of those thugs from whichever stupid, I think it was it Greenpeace? I don't know. But at any rate, it's okay to intimidate witnesses when the Democrats do it, but not when anybody else does it. I'm relaxed about that. If the president issued a tweet today about this Ukrainian ambassador, seems a bit, you know, who did this delicate flower routine for the amusement of Democrats. And Adam Schiff suggested that the president's tweet was an attempt to intimidate a witness, and that tweet alone is grounds to remove him from office. Bring it on! Bring it on! At this stage, you're inviting a revolution, but bring it on! Remove him from office. I think I said to Tucker last night, when people say, "Oh, this is all a waste of time because he's never going to be convicted in the Senate, so he'll never be removed from office." I wouldn't be so sure about that. When you look at an opportunist, virtue signaling twerp like Mitt Romney, and then you start to think about some of the other characters on the so-called Republican side of the aisle, I wouldn't actually rule it out that you could get pretty close to convicting and removing Trump from office. And if they did do that, if I were Trump, I'd run for president all over again. Let him convict him and remove him from president and remove him from the presidency, and he should just run in Iowa and New Hampshire next year, all over again anyway. But at some point, you can't make the case that a tweet is intimidating a witness. This is stupid talk. There's a thing called the First Amendment in this country, and Trump has the same right as anybody else to say what he wants about a talentless ambassador. I mean, I don't wish her ill or anything, but you look at where she served, Somalia, well, whoop-de-doo. So she was ambassador to Somalia. That's supposed to impress people? Have you seen Somalia lately? David Kelly Wood says, "Mark, do you think the House Democrats are going to press on with impeachment all the way to a formal charge and vote? I'm having visions of the charge of the Light Brigade with Trump caster Sirat Khan and the rationale for impeachment in the role of the attacking force." I think I've already done this, David. Didn't I do that the other day? Into the Valley of the Skiff rode the 600 hearsay witnesses. I think I did something like that. And as was it Walt Trimmer pointed out in the comments, it's exactly the Crimean War, charge of the Light Brigade, and today's impeachment are all exactly the same things, because then as now, it was a charge against the Russians. The Russians now have been charged with interfering in US elections, and they're not going to let that go. Richard Moore says, "The hearings today seem about as rigorous as a Title IX hearing at Penn State University. The notion that the State Department has become a workspace that operates by HR standards and provides safe spaces for tender ambassadors is ludicrous. Please comment on the comedy." Nobody cares about Ukraine except Ukrainians and Russians and people in the neighborhood. And they're the ones who should care about it. But if you ask me whether Americans are going to remove a president for Ukraine, they're not. What we've seen in the last couple of days is a good reminder of George Shultz's old gag. When he'd call in newly appointed ambassadors and he had a globe on his desk and he'd spin the globe and he'd ask the newly appointed ambassador to point to his or her country. And so an ambassador to Ukraine would like look on the map for Ukraine and point to Ukraine. And George Shultz would always say no and put his finger down on the United States and say, that is your country. And we have listened to absolutely ridiculous talk the last couple of days that Ukraine, actually, I'm fed up with saying Ukraine. I'm going to call it the Ukraine like it should be, like it should be. The Ukraine. Hunter Biden's got the. He was given the definite article of the Ukraine as his Christmas bonus by the board of Burisma. It's on display in his house now. The Ukraine. These ambassadors saying, "Oh, the Ukraine's a full it's a full security partner of the United." Why would we want the Ukraine in NATO? Are you out of your mind? So that the next time the Russians have taken the Crimea and Donbass, which is a portmanteau word, it's the Donets Basin. If you know your Donets River, I was there many years ago. And as river basins go, it's nice. Donbass. But the idea that Donbass is worth the bones of an American grenadier is preposterous. Russia's just taken Crimea and Donbass. Suppose it decides to take more of Ukraine. And if the Ukraine's in NATO, we then have to go to war against Russia. Now, you look at it the other way around, because if you look at the Crimea in relation to the United States, and I'll reiterate this point because it's worth making. What is the territorial of integrity of the Ukraine to an American? It's certainly of interest to the Russians, because this is, for example, like the Russians claiming that when these bow-tied twits on TV yesterday, the day before, claimed that the Ukraine is a vital national security interest of the United States. The borders of the Ukraine were a vital national security interest of the United States. That's the equivalent of Russia claiming that the Rio Grande, the Mexican border on the Rio Grande, is a vital national security interest of Russia. It's actually a vital national security interest. The Rio Grande is a vital national security interest of the United States, but that doesn't count. We're more worried about the bloody Donbass, which Adam Schiff wouldn't know if he fell on his head. We're more worried about the borders of the Donbass than of the open borders of the United States. That's not going to go anywhere. It's a joke. I'll tell you another thing, too. Twitter shut these accounts down this morning. A thing started on Twitter, a meme or whatever you called it. It said, in 2016, I hired Donald Trump to fire people like these ambassadors. And Twitter was so shocked by that that they've taken all those things down. This is good. Actually, I mentioned, was this when I was on Rush a couple of days ago? Susan Thomas writes, "Chow Mark, I'd ask someone to complete a poem about Adam Schiff." And Susan Thomas and her husband, Rich, from Port Townsend in Washington, have so done it. "Old Adam Schiff came out of the skiff and glanced all about his domain. After dinner with wine, everything will be fine. Then back to the same old refrain. Old Adam Schiff came out of the skiff with his moon face all lighted aglow. We're winning again. Trump will be in the pen." Then oozed back to his lair down below. "Old Adam Schiff came out of the skiff with evidence incontrovertible. The proof only he with his clearance can see remains secret so that it's pervertible." Yes, indeed. A lot of perversion of justice going on in the skiff, Susan. Mark F from Colorado says, "Please riff some more on George Conway's terrible haircut." Well, it was a terrible haircut. And I don't think I meant what I said. Did I mention Andrew Lloyd Webber? He'd had a haircut like that in the late 80s and early 90s. And I happened to see there was some survey conducted, and it found out that Andrew Lloyd Webber had made more money than all other British composers combined in the previous millennium. So from Purcell or whoever it was up to Paul McCartney. And I don't know how you'd even go about finding, actually establishing that. But it was a plausible statistic, and it was in a newspaper, whatever it was, 30 years ago. And I happened to see Andrew at his home at Sidmonton a couple of days after that. And I slyly put to him in a rather circuitous way that if he's made more money than all other British composers combined in the previous millennium, he could afford to get a decent haircut, because it was a weird haircut. And I felt a bit bad, but I felt a bit bad actually saying that about George Conway, because there's a real tragedy going on here. This was in relation to that clip of Wolf Blitzer. He's got Kellyanne Conway, who's a counselor to the president. She stayed there since day one. Everyone else has been fired. They've come and gone. She stayed there, which says something about how much he values her. What also says something about how much Trump values is that he puts up with her husband. Because the best way to make George Conway go away would be to fire Kellyanne Conway, and then who cares about George Conway? But George Conway, he's supposed to be a legal scholar, and yet he's put up on the airwaves. He never talks about points of law. He just talks about what a sociopath the president is. That's all he does. And that's interesting to me, because you can say what you like about Trump's personality, but I think you'd have to be far more sociopathic to do what George Conway does and go on TV, go on MSNBC, and make these comments about Trump, knowing what it's doing, knowing that it's putting additional strain on Kellyanne, on your wife and the mother of your children. And I mentioned when Brian Kilmeade brought this up on the radio that Kellyanne and I were given awards by the Independent Women's Forum a year or two back. And so they have a big dinner at Washington, and we go there and we're at the top table, and Kellyanne's got her young kids there. And I was struck by the fact that her husband wasn't there, because after all, he lives just 10 minutes away, so it's not far to go or whatever. But what's going on in that household is ineffably sad. Really, it is. What's interesting is that George Conway's loathing of Trump. People talk about Trump derangement syndrome, and it's an expression for most people, because if you're like a Democrat activist, it costs you nothing to hate Trump. Everyone you go to at parties hates Trump. You sit across dinner every night from people who hate Trump. It's different when your wife works for the guy. I don't know why anyone would do this for the sake of a slot on MSNBC, so that some twit, the guy who bores the pants off you at gate 27 at LaGuardia when your plane's 3 hours late, bloody Wolf Blitzer, who if it wasn't for people trapped at gates from this totally dysfunctional air traffic control system, would have no viewers at all. It's so that Wolf Blitzer will say nice things about you. It's worth. Let's say you loathe Trump, and your wife works for Trump, and you really just can't take. Why not just take a job in Singapore or Hong Kong for a couple of years and sit out the thing? I don't know. It's very sad. This. Where are we going? Haircut. It is a terrible haircut, though. Anyway, William Strook says, "Dear Mark, however much Brexit this deal actually delivers," this is Boris's Brexit deal, which has got an Irish backstop in it, because we all love the Irish backstop. It was my favourite novelty dance of the 1960s. "Dear Mark, however much Brexit this deal actually delivers, isn't it true that over time the Brits will sever more and more ties with the EU? Isn't Boris's deal similar to De Valera's in 1921? And if you don't follow Irish politics, Éamon de Valera he subsequently became the Taoiseach or to shock, as Trump said. But the T-shock, as most of us say, in Ireland in the 1930s. What William is referring to there is when the after the Irish decided to hell with Britain, they wanted to be done with it, and the London had treaty talks with the so-called Irish Republicans, and De Valera actually held out for a republic, and I think, and Lloyd George wrote to him, I think this is almost an exact quote, saying, "What you seek is not in our gift." And so what happened was, you know, the Irish Free State and the Governor General and the oath to the Crown and all the things that are familiar from Canada, Australia, everywhere else. You know what I'm talking about. And De Valera objected to it, and Michael Collins didn't. And my great uncle's friend, Arthur Griffith, my great uncle, I think I mentioned, was Arthur Griffith's lawyer. And Arthur Griffith and Michael Collins took one side and De Valera took another. And there was an Irish civil war broke out. And in the end, the pro-free state forces prevailed. And Michael Collins described, he said, "This isn't freedom, but it's the freedom to achieve freedom." And a decade later, when De Valera came to power, when De Valera's party was elected and won the Irish general election, and he looked through all the files, particularly the files relating to communications between Dublin and London, he admitted that Michael Collins had been right. It was the freedom to achieve freedom. Now, I don't know, and that said, by the way, I think if you look at it, I wouldn't say it was altogether a blessing, because some of the things that De Valera would do in the next decade or so percolated out to the rest of the Commonwealth, and they actually had a rather bad effect, to my way of thinking, in Canada and Australia and places. But that's just my view. Feel free to disagree. Anyway, the question here is whether it's going to go that way with Boris's Brexit deal and the European Union. And it could do, certainly, if Boris was determined. It's also the case, though, that the European Union is not like London in 1922, and certainly not like London in 1936. In other words, it's not going to be as generous in that situation. Brussels is not going to have the general spirit of generosity in which London operated. It certainly should be. And I certainly think these measures to which Boris has agreed ought to be temporary, because they are undoubtedly infringements of sovereignty. Marie writes, "My only question to you, are you eligible to serve as the British EU Commissioner? And if so, would you accept if Boris Johnson appointed you if he wins the election?" I don't think I am, actually. Canadian citizens are eligible to vote in the United Kingdom, and we are eligible to sit in the cabinet of the United Kingdom, and we are eligible to become Knights of the Garter and members of the Order of Merit and all kinds of things. But I take it, as this is some European thing, I can't see why the European Council would permit a Canadian to represent the United Kingdom on it. So I very much doubt I am. But I see that Brussels is threatened to sue Boris for refusing to appoint an EU commissioner. Toby Pilling says, "Why has Boris Johnson not championed any electoral form like abolishing the House of Lords or scrapping the corrupt practices around postal voting? Nigel Farage might have dropped more Brexit Party candidates if he had." Yes, indeed, Toby, we can all agree on this, that Boris's slogan is "Get Brexit Done." But aside from Brexit, this is a ghastly, for a so-called Conservative Party. Boris says he's the most liberal leader of the Tory Party there's ever been. And you certainly see it when you look at this manifesto. This is not a Conservative manifesto. And it's very disquieting. in that respect. Brian in Northumberland, which is part of the United Kingdom, although it's quite north, it's quite near Scotland, so Scotland might annex it before it secedes from the UK and rejoins the EU. I'm just looking ahead a couple of years. Good movie plot if you're anyone from the BBC or ITV is listening. Hi, Mark. Vis-a-vis Nigel Farage's withdrawing the Brexit Party from all 600-plus constituencies, do you think he has done right for country rather than self, or do you feel he has sold out to Boris? I'm confident most sensible folk here in the UK aren't too keen on Mr. Corbyn's utopia, but your thoughts on the socialisation of the youth in USA has already arrived in the UK, says Brian in Northumberland. Well, you know, we don't know. Nigel Farage is the most consequential politician of the last 30 years in the United Kingdom, even though he has never been Prime Minister or Foreign Secretary or Chancellor of the Exchequer or Lord Chancellor or Home Secretary or anything else. He's never sat in the Palace of Westminster as an elected Member of Parliament. And yet he has been more consequential than all the boobs who have done, including the boobs who've served as Prime Minister, post-Thatcher, because he overturned the bipartisan consensus on the central reality of post-war British foreign policy or post-imperial foreign policy, that post-empire Britain had no future except as part of a Europe-wide federation. And he said nuts to that, and he prevailed. And so that makes him more consequential than John Major. Let's put aside all the Labour types. That makes him more consequential than all the Tories who are his natural fellows. Makes him more consequential than John Major or David Cameron or any of them. I'm not sure. We know that he would have preferred a no-deal Brexit. The question he had to answer was whether holding out for a no-deal Brexit would have jeopardized any kind of Brexit. In other words, would it simply have delivered Jeremy Corbyn to number 10 as part of a Lib Dem Scottish National Party coalition, one of the conditions of which was that he would scrap Brexit altogether. And I think he made a calculation. In a sense, he was very unfortunate. He peaked in May, Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party, with that triumphant showing in the European elections. And had the Conservative Party elected as its leader anybody but Boris, the Brexit Party's numbers would have stayed high and he would have had a very good shot at actually depressing Conservative turnout and actually taking a lot of seats. The danger he played here was that he'd just be a spoiler delivering number 10 to Jeremy Corbyn. And I don't think he is one of nature's Tories. He only founded these other parties because the Tories betrayed their own base on Brexit. And I think he faced a difficult choice. Joseph Dornish writes, since we know the border between Russia and the Ukraine is more important than the border between the US and Mexico to the USA, similarly, the borders of Turkey, Syria, Kurdistan, Iraq, and Iran are also all more important to the USA than our border with Mexico. Is, say, the border between Poland and Belarus also more important to the USA than our border with Mexico? Absolutely, Joseph. This is the insanity. This is the insanity of it. I mean, the same people who are saying that the borders of Donbass are a critical national security issue for the United States are in favor of open borders for the United States. Every border in the world is more important than the United States border for these people. It doesn't matter what the borders of Montenegro are more important. The borders of Chad are more important. The borders of Uzbekistan are more important. Any border is more important than the American border. If you want to defend the American border, you're a racist. But if you want to protect the territorial integrity of Ukraine, well, then you're a sophisticated, nuanced, invaluable public servant whose years, decades of public service are invaluable. This is actually what got Trump elected. Nothing anybody talks about is relevant to most Americans. When we came in 2015, when Trump came down that escalator, the Democrats were all talking about, oh, transgender bathrooms. They were talking about, okay, it's one thing, you know, okay, women's rights, okay, gay rights, you know, people know women. People know gays. They were, you know, even if it's just, you know, Uncle Bill's always been a bit different, and every so often he goes up to town for a couple of days. Everyone, most of these other boutique identity groups that the Democrats are now talking about, most people have never encountered anyone, but they somehow, the right of someone to a biological male to compete in a girls' track event in the Connecticut track championships is more important than whether millions and millions of boring white rural Americans, Rust Belt Americans, whether they have any jobs or not. And that was part of the thing. That's what the Democrats were talking about. Meanwhile, on the Republican side, the people were talking about all kinds of countries that we need boots on the ground on, more endless wars for Lindsey Graham and Marco Rubio, I think, was threatening to go to war with Russia at one point. He was so mad with Russia. I don't know why. Most America, the people who actually serve in the United States Armed Forces have learned a lot since 2001 about going to war with no serious strategic goals, about going to war and dithering in an ineffectual occupation. Sometimes you get handed those cards. If you're a colonial power, you exercise sovereignty over certain terrain, and you're obliged to defend it, as the British Army did in Malaya during the Malayan insurgency, you know, and as they did in Northern Ireland in the 70s and 80s. But if you are not there as the sovereign power of that terrain, why would you do it? Like Malaya, at the time Malaya was British, so okay, the British Army have to go and fight the commies. But if it wasn't, why would an American want to go there? If you're not serious about, and this is actually what got Trump elected, is that this prioritizing of a foreign ministry isn't supposed to be the ministry for foreigners. It's supposed to prosecute the national interest of the United States. The national interest of the United States. Ukraine, in the scheme of things, isn't important. It's important because it's corrupt and its corruption infects other places that are slightly more important, like Cyprus. But other than that, it's not important. Left Coaster says, Hunter Biden cannot be the only son to benefit from his father's corruption. Do you think we will ever know of similar deals benefiting Beau in his time? The whole Biden family, and I spoke about this on Rush, people have a high tolerance for corruption. I don't think they should, but they do. But they do. But I don't think, so the fact that Joe Biden made more money in the year after he ceased to be vice president than he did in the previous 20 years combined is just business as usual in the United States. It makes me vomit. But it doesn't make millions of Americans vomit. But I don't think they extend the same courtesies to the son. And I don't think they're going to be able to. The Biden family are sleazy and corrupt. Jill Biden, who I always thought was a perfectly pleasant woman, received more for her book advance than it can ever possibly remake. There is the stench of it. I'll say one other thing too. Roger Stone, he's 67 years old and he's just been corrupted of lying to Congress, just been convicted of lying to Congress. And he's looking at 50 years in jail under the moronic, you know, anyone who's been in an American courthouse We had this thing with some guy in New Hampshire who stole a couple of checks from us and put some zeros on, rather a lot of zeros on them. Winds up in court. We're told, oh yeah, he's this is a felony, that's a felony. He could be looking at 49 years in jail. Of course, he pleads it down to two misdemeanors. They don't want to put him in jail at all. It took actually some effort to get him into jail where he belongs. But this whole what we have, but nevertheless, if you lie to Congress like Roger Stone, you'll be going to jail for 50 years. So he's 67 and he'll be going to jail till he's 117. He will die in jail, Roger Stone. Now, Roger Stone is a fairly dodgy, shifty character. I don't think anyone would dispute that. He doesn't seem like a Boy Scout. But the fact is, here's my problem with it. He, lying to Congress, he's going to go to jail for 50 years. This guy who's in Congress, Adam Schiff, has lied and lied and lied. He lied about, he kept saying, oh yeah, he'd seen evidence of collusion between Trump and Russia. Okay, well, why didn't you give, if you've seen that evidence, why didn't you give that evidence to Robert Mueller, who was your boy? You know, that was a straight up lie. He lied when he said that he had had no contact with the so-called whistleblower. The whistleblower had actually met, if not with Schiff personally, then at least with his staff. He lied just on Wednesday when he said he didn't know the name of the whistleblower. He's a liar. He's a liar. But he skates, and for lying to Congress, Roger Stone is going to jail for 50 years. This is a sick and evil system. A sick and evil system. And at some point, people are going to see the way it shapes. Right now, for example, we're supposed to be waiting for the Inspector General's report, for the Intelligence Community Inspector General's report, and everyone's very excited because they think, oh, you know, he might be recommending criminal indictments of Comey, might be recommending criminal indictments of Brennan and McCabe and all the rest of them. Really? Because right now, if you just look at it, it seems to be this way, that every Democrat skates and every Republican winds up going to jail. And if you don't have equality before the law, you don't have law. You just have caprices, which is the problem with the evil, and I mean that, the evil so-called federal justice system, which is entirely capricious and always in the same way. The Republican is looking at 50 years in jail. He's going to die behind bars. That's not something Comey is worried about. That's not something Brennan is worried about. Robert Ellis says, have any of Elizabeth Warren's siblings ever claimed minority status? Well, she got the one. There was one 1,024th of Native American blood to be got. And I think she got that. And it didn't transmit to any of the siblings. I will say this about Elizabeth Warren. I think one of the reasons she's doing very well is because she has sort of established the complete authenticity of her inauthenticity. So no one's interested in Elizabeth Warren talking about any of that sort of personal stuff. The Mayor Pete bores on about. Mayor Pete keeps doing these in-depth tongue sarnies, as they say in the UK, with his husband on stage. Say, oh yes, I'm a gay man and I'm married and this is my husband. Do you mind if I kiss him for 20 minutes now? And Elizabeth Warren, because she's the whole Native American thing blew up in her face, she can't do that. So she just actually talked about policy, talked about fleecing billionaires and multi-trillion dollar programs for this and that. And as a result, she's galloped ahead. And I think in some strange way, she has established that her core character is authentically inauthentic, and it's actually worked out very well for her. Todd Lewis says, I used to think the Democrats were the masters of the optics in the political tableau they created. They seem to have completely lost the handle on this. They're in a bubble that is fast running out of oxygen. Their optics continue to get creepier and creepier all the time. The left is so out of touch with reality, they can't even mimic it anymore. Yeah, the kind of fish eyes of Adam Schiff are, I find personally, rather creepy. But I think the central narrative is what failed to take hold. The Democrats keep presenting these people as old, distinguished public servants. We're so grateful. Thank you for your service, your decades of service. Service, 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 service. George Kent. There have been George Kent serving with the public service in the State Department for whatever he said the other day, 6 decades or whatever. I didn't know that. I didn't know the George Kent family. I think he's George III. I didn't know the George Kent family were a permanent fixture of Washington. I didn't know there were these great hereditary sinecures in Washington. But I tell you this, the more the Democrats go about how distinguished they are, the more Mr. and Mrs. America look at that guy and think he's just some dork in a bow tie. I don't think anybody thought, though. They seem rather highly strung. And they seem to think they shouldn't ever be questioned, and they're less esteemed than self-esteemed. I don't think that's catching on. Oh, here's a Roger Stone question. Roger Stone was found guilty, says Robert Stewart, and now faces essentially a life sentence for things like 5 counts of lying to Congress and witness tampering. The prosecutor, Jonathan Kravis, said Roger Stone had no intention of being truthful with the committee. He's just making stuff up. Stone's arrest was accomplished in the early morning hours with 29 FBI agents armed with automatic weapons, 2 boats and 1 helicopter, all for the benefit of the CNN reporters who broadcast the takedown and, of course, to set the stage for the jury trial. That's disgusting, too. It isn't really funny. It isn't really funny. Everyone thinks it's funny when the G-men pull stunts like this. I often mention this when they said they got Al Capone for tax evasion. And everyone thinks it's very clever. It's not really. It's the inability to get Al Capone on what he was doing actually speaks very poorly for the FBI. And again, the use of process crimes speaks badly for them. And again, this shock and awe business for white-collar infractions, I think is absolutely disgusting. 29 FBI agents armed with... Are there no men among these G-men? You know, you're told to go... 29 guys, you're told to go and take some 67-year-old fella whose crime is that he was buddies with Donald Trump and lied to Congress. So you think, oh, he's accused of lying to Congress. I'm going to need an automatic weapon to take this guy down. We're going to need boats and helicopters. Are there no men at the FBI? Is there no one who says, well, this is a bit unbecoming. Don't we look ridiculous? Don't we look like a bunch of fairies dorising around some 67-year-old guy's house with automatic weapons and boats and helicopters? The next step, says Robert, will be sentencing, which can often take a year or more. Yeah, that's the other thing. I love this. They say, oh, you've been convicted of this, that, and the other. We'll now, it's, what are we today? It's November the 15th, so we'll have a sentencing hearing next March. Oh, says opposing counsel, I can't make next March because I'm going to be... fishing in the Bahamas. I'm going to be skiing in Japan. It's my anniversary, and I promised my wife we'd go skiing. Okay, so we can't do March. Let's make it. How does the following August work? I miss that thing that you get in if you watch, you'll know this if you watch any English courtroom drama on PBS, where the guy's found guilty and the judge goes, take him down. And he's taken down into the cells, put in the van and taken away to prison to start the 20-year sentence. Here, the 20-year sentence doesn't begin until a year after you've been convicted, because then there's all the bloody sentencing. That's another thing that should change. I reiterate my offer to be Trump's attorney general, because this whole thing needs to change. Isn't it strange, says Robert Stewart, that the chairman of a House committee can open his hearing with remarks that amount to nothing more than 10 or 15 minutes of lies deemed to be parody when the expected testimony didn't live up to the advance billing, while their targets face financial ruin and death in prison for 5 or 10 poorly chosen words. It isn't strange. As I said, Adam Schiff is a serial liar. I don't believe a word he says about anything. All kinds of people involved in this fake Russia investigation, which was in fact the subversion, the organized subversion of the Trump campaign by the deep state. All these guys have lied. But as I said, they're not looking at it. Do you really believe when the inspector... I watch people on television, they're getting excited because they said, oh, it was supposed to be out. No, I'm told now, my contacts tell me that it's going to be coming out in a week's time. And then the week goes by and it doesn't come out. And the contacts are now telling you it's going to be next month. And then next month comes and goes and it still doesn't come out. When it does come out, are you seriously expecting to see James Comey in a courtroom convicted and going to jail? Are you seriously expecting that? Robert Fox says, recently the CEO of Twitter announced they wouldn't be accepting campaign advertising. In the weeks after the November 2016 election, I recall reading an article describing how Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner assembled a group of young tech-savvy individuals to go about implementing a strategy leveraging social media platforms to target certain key areas of battleground states with campaign ads. Particularly in states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, this was a game-changing weapon in the campaign's arsenal. Do you think the Twitter CEO's announcement about not accepting campaign advertising is an attempt to remove that weapon from the Trump campaign? I don't know about that, Robert. I think Twitter is less important than people think it is. It is important for someone like Trump because he uses it basically to drive the media mad, because it's a lot of media people and things on Twitter. I generally think Google and Facebook are far more important. They are news sources and they are a cartel, and they're a cartel that are increasingly comfortable about excluding types of news. The whole idea of the search engine, this is one of the things I'm going to be talking to Douglas Murray about on Tuesday, because Douglas has a fascinating passage in his book. The way if you search for certain approved topics, they will show you more or less the search results you'd expect to get. If you search for certain other kinds of news, they don't do that. There is human intervention to make it harder for you to access the news you really want to get. And they're serious about that. We don't have, increasingly, more than 50% of Americans get their news principally from Facebook and Google, which is a horrible thought. Horrible. And they're going to try and fakey-fake that, obviously, to prevent Trump's re-election. That goes without saying. Tom Brook writes, Mark, after their 8-year slumber during the Obama presidency, the media behemoth has risen up with one voice to condemn Donald J. Trump and all those who support him, but they seem not to be able to move the needle much. Are the narratives they are pushing so flawed that people see through them, or have they revealed themselves as such partisan hacks that the people have tuned them out? Would a real story be disregarded? Are they bad stories, bad reporters, or both? Well, I think this actually is the kind of flip side of what I was saying to Robert Fox, is that over 50% of Americans get their news via Google and Facebook, and they pay less and less attention to the New York Times and CNN and the Washington Post and NBC. And I think those people have generally been tuned out. And they aren't able to move the needle much because, in a sense, when you... The thing about Google and Facebook is it presents as not news. It presents as some kind of, you know, something other than news. It's your feed or it's what you've searched for in the search engine. But news as news, in the old-fashioned sense of a newspaper or a news network, these people have made it ridiculous, and And I think that's actually one of the problems with when people say news people acting as news people. So Brian Williams, for example, I never got the thing with Brian Williams. He always seemed to me just like, if you want your news delivered from a 1950s department store mannequin, then Brian Williams was a great guy. But I don't know that many people do want their news delivered by a 1950s department store mannequin. And when you see him talking about a presidency in peril, and he has this marvelous baritone voice ringing clear, and someone's written an alliterative script for him to look into the camera and read off the teleprompter, I think all that's people, that just seems totally Squaresville now. And it would be ridiculous even if they weren't over egging the pudding. But I also think people grasp an essential of it, that it is that there is a kind of theater about it, and they are indulging in just in the rituals of these things. Pooh Bear writes, "Dear Mark, can you explain to me what kind of working class American would vote for the Democrats in these times? It is a mystery to me." Well, they said after the Obama victories that those voters in the Rust Belt states were going away and they wouldn't be coming back, and they had no interest in getting them back. And the whole strategy of the Democrats has been to assemble a coalition of the margins, as they call it, by which they mean Hispanics and gays and blacks and transgenders and Muslims, and that if you get enough of those, it outvotes everybody else. I don't know that doesn't actually appear to be true, and of course it overlooks the fact that a lot of those guys don't always get on with each other, coalition of the margins. A lot of black guys, for example, aren't keen on Mayor Pete because of the way he keeps sticking his tongue down his husband's throat on stage all the time. They just don't dig that. It's like, I don't know whether I'm going to go the same way as Don Cherry for saying that, but it's something that it's perfectly obvious, and it shows in the percentage of the black vote that Mayor Pete is attracting. Now, Hillary didn't attract a lot of the black vote either. And that was a part of the problem, that by she didn't enthuse them enough to come out and vote. But if you're to go back to what I was saying, yeah, I think if you're just a regular working class stiff, if just like a regular Joe, I don't think that the Democrats have anything very much to say to you. And I don't think by the same token, increasingly, this is in a sense what the whole Ukraine thing is about. Oh, I voted for Trump because he promised to build a wall on the U.S. border and he promised to bring jobs back to the United States. So he got rid of the Ukrainian ambassador, so we're going to have to remove him from office now. Who cares about that? The politics discredits itself. The interesting thing now is that when everything becomes political, then at a certain sense, nothing is political because politicians are spending so much time talking about things that are actually of no interest to anyone and have no impact on people's lives. Here's a big question from George Pazin. Says, do you believe in American exceptionalism? If so, what do you think it means? If not, please explain why not. Thanks. Here's my short thinking. American exceptionalism is not pride in the country, as President Barry stated, and it's not just the embracing of freedom, as others have stated or implied. In my humble opinion, it is an attempt by the founders through the Declaration, the Constitution, particularly the Bill of Rights, and its founding premise of rights granted by God/a creator, hedging your bets a bit there, aren't you, George? And a system of attempted checks and balances to fight any attempts to encroach on that freedom. I could bore you with more, but would like to hear your thoughts. This is probably a too big a subject for our last question, George, or penultimate question. But the last big discussion of American exceptionalism I had was actually in jail, federal prison, with my friend and former boss, Conrad Black. I'd gone to see him in federal prison in Miami. And we were in it's a big room, and all the murderers and drug dealers are being visited by their moles. And Conrad's being visited by me. And he asked me to go and get him a candy bar from the machine, because the prisoners aren't allowed to go and get the candy bar from the machine. So I did that, got one for myself, and then we sat down and had a conversation on American exceptionalism, as all the other actual Americans in the room wondered what the hell these two Canadians were talking about. That was the longest discussion I've had in recent years on American exceptionalism. You're right that it's not pride in the country. Every country, its countrymen have a certain amount of pride in. And that pride transcends, I think, the political arrangements. If you look at the way the Russians fought against the Germans in the Second World War, for example, during those great sieges, so you're walled up in cities, you're starving and all of it. People wouldn't fight like that if they thought the political system was the be-all and end-all of a country. They certainly weren't fighting for communism or the Communist Party. They're fighting for their motherland. And that's generally been true throughout human history. You fight, you love your country. A Swede loves Sweden because he's Swedish. That's why you love your country. And that's not what when Obama said his thing about, oh, I think Americans feel that America is exceptional, just as the Greeks feel that Greece is exceptional. That's not what American exceptionalism is. It's essentially about a mission. Or an identity for the nation that transcends considerations of mere blood loyalty, as it were. That arises, I think, from the nature of the American Revolution. They revolted against their co-ethnics, their fellow Englishmen, Scotsmen, and Irishmen back in the UK. So they threw off an ethnic solidarity with the English, Scots, and Irish on the other side of the ocean, and in the mythos replaced it with a certain constitutional values that transcend ethnicity, and that's certainly valid. When you get what's interesting to me, though, is it isn't the whole story. As recently as 1990, I believe it was, a survey found that half the people in the country, their ancestors had been here before July 4th, 1776. So, in other words, if you put up a border wall on July the 4th, 1776, in 1990, half the people in the country were still the descendants of people who'd been there on July the 4th, 1776. So there was an ethnic component to America's growth and American prosperity, and it was augmented by the Germans and the Russians and all the people who came before they closed the immigration thing in the mid-1920s. So I don't like the idea that constitutionalism exists in a vacuum. It's a set of ideas that came from where Americans came from. It was English. They were English ideas that were taken further than Englishmen were prepared to go at that time. But they're nevertheless rooted in English ideas, going back to Magna Carta and things. Where I think it gets difficult is that man does not live by abstractions, and a proposition nation is a nice thing. Whether the proposition can simply be extended, as the open borders Democrats now seem to think, to 7 billion people on the planet. In other words, if you have open borders and everyone moves here, whether you still have American exceptionalism, I don't know. And I worry because I listen to young people and I don't detect... I think I made this point to someone the other day, that if you look at, say, radical ideas in the United States, for example, the suffragette movement, or the civil rights movement, or gay rights, most of what's happened since July 4th, 1776, listen to the suffragettes at Seneca Falls, they placed what they were doing within the context of the Constitution. In other words, they're trying to write themselves into the Constitution, the suffragettes. Same thing with Martin Luther King with his speeches. He's trying to write himself and African Americans into the Constitution. Same thing even with Harvey Milk in San Francisco. He's saying gay rights, writing it into the Constitution. And actually now what's happened, just in the last 5-6 years, that's not how radical ideas are thought. There's no writing into the Constitution. In fact, the New York Times is trying to overturn 1776 and replace it with 1619, the foundation of slavery in the United States, as they see it. So whether you're talking about the New York Times or on the Antifa kids at campus or anybody at campus, really, I'm not sure about whether American exceptionalism rooted in the Constitution has that grip on them, George. This has been, this is like a big question for the final question. It's maybe worth a signpost or something. But I think it becomes, in the end, no nation is entirely a proposition nation. It goes back to where we came in. It goes back to what Don Cherry was talking about on Remembrance Day, that if you were to have, say, 350 million Americans and 170 million of them are Muslims who've come here from Yemen or Somalia or whatever, I don't think the Constitution and the Declaration would have that much purchase on them. You know, there are things that have American exceptionalism rooted in a set of ideas of liberty depends as much as anything else on a broad societal consensus. And that's what is fraying at the moment. Let's see what else we have. Oh, Deborah McKenzie. Hi, Mark. What do you think of the reference to McRae's poem in Flanders Fields being written on the cenotaph in Toronto to protest the firing of Don Cherry? The man who did it said Canadians have indeed broken faith with the Canadian soldiers who died in both world wars, because we are allowing our cultural right to freedom of speech, amongst the rights they fought and died for, to be subverted and squashed by an increasingly authoritarian state. I'm never sure about this. People are citizens of good countries and bad countries, and that always doesn't always determine how they fight. You fight for the land you love. And I'm not sure, we say this, oh, people were fighting in the Second World War for values. And Enoch Powell and Mrs. Thatcher had a much more eloquent, this comes back to what George was saying. Enoch Powell and Mrs. Thatcher had a big argument about this. And Mrs. Thatcher used to take a rather American view that people fight for values, people fight for abstractions. And Enoch Powell said, nonsense, even if this country... if this country had a communist government and someone invaded it, I'd still fight for England because I'm English. And people fight for Canada because they're Canadian. And yes, in the scales of history, Canadians are better and have a better track record than Germans and Russians and all the rest of it. What it's more basic than that, Deborah. People aren't because in theory, the whole planet could have freedom of speech or freedom of this or freedom of that. When you go to war, when you're sitting there in the muck and bullets on the Western Front, it's more primal than that. It's for your land. It's for Canada. It's because you don't want Canada occupied by a foreign power. It's because you don't want to be under the jackboot of Germany or the, and what he means by breaking faith is if people are willing to lay down their lives for their country, then the idea that then people just start walking around thinking nothing of that sacrifice and actually thinking nothing of their country, that's what's breaking faith about it. That's what's breaking faith about it. As I said, these are big topics, these last two questions, and I didn't really address them with the scope they deserve, but maybe we'll put them to one side and return to them for a signpost or some sense, some such. But both north and south of the border, things are changing very fast here, very fast, very fast. And the question is whether traditional ideas of nationhood still hold their grip on the young citizens of these countries. This has been a rather longer than usual Clubland Q&A. I hope you don't mind. It gone a bit long, and I shouldn't have done that. But we will be, I hope to see some of you in Montreal next week. And I hope to you will join me again for our next Clubland Q&A in a week and a half's time, fortnight's time, whatever it is. We will see you next time.